We spoke at the end of the last hour about John Wycliffe. You found out what I know yesterday, and today I'll find out what you know tomorrow about him and other subjects. But in a way, I wish we could take 2 or 3 hours on John Wycliffe instead of the brief time we had, because he certainly is one of the most important characters in church history, yes?
It's true that John Wycliffe was the first of all.
That is the sort of a question that is impossible to answer. There is no question that John Wycliffe very strongly spoke of the Pope as the Antichrist and representing a system that was in opposition to all true Christianity. He used very strong language and spoke at considerable length about it, largely in writing toward the end of his life. Now, whether there were others who had briefly spoken along the same line before, it would take a very considerable amount of research to say. And I have not specifically tried to investigate on that question. I would hesitate about saying he was the first who did it, because in the conflict, well, as a matter of fact, in the previous centuries, when you had the big conflict with between the emperor and Pope John 23rd, and some of the Franciscans were writing about the wickedness of John 23rd, he might very well, he and the Avignon popes have been called such. I don't know. I haven't investigated. But Wycliffe did speak, though, about the Pope, and not specifically of one so much as about the general system. So that you can certainly say that he is the first one who took such a position in a strong and pronounced way of which there was widespread knowledge. I think you could say that. But otherwise, such statements are very, very difficult to make. Wycliffe's mind represented a considerable development through the years. So did Luther. So have most innovators. That, of course, is the great difference between Luther and Calvin. Luther was the great innovator of the Reformation, starting with a thorough belief in the whole system as it then existed, but becoming tremendously convinced of the overriding importance of salvation by faith. He gradually tested one thing after another in the light of the Scripture, and his thoughts developed as he dealt with one matter after another. Calvin was a second generation reformer who could come into a situation in which the lines were already drawn, the great emphases had already been brought out, the major issues had already been discussed, and he could take what was already known, study it further with his own great incisive, clear mind, fit it together, and present it as a coordinated system early in his life, and at the end of his life, be developing and enlarging on the explanation of what he presented, but with no vital change in view from the beginning of his ministry to the end. That you can do when you are falling along in something that is already well established, even if not yet widely accepted. But when you are like Luther, one who makes a tremendous change in the world, you can't just sit down and say, what would be a perfect world? Let's think of a perfect system. Let's start in and give this. You're like taking a train that's standing still and trying all of a sudden to start pulling it at 60 miles an hour. You just break your connection. You don't get anywhere. The one who does that usually is one who gradually sees things and develops his understanding as Luther did. Now, you might say in a way this is even more true of Wycliffe, because Wycliffe came earlier than Luther. Wycliffe went just as far as Luther did. But Wycliffe did not get the train moving as Luther did. Wycliffe made a very tremendous impact, not only on England, but on Europe as a whole. But the impact was speedily stopped, stifled, almost completely ended, so that the followers of Wycliffe at the time of Luther were few and far between. But Wycliffe was one of the great scholars of the 14th century. He was one of the great minds, one of the great clear writers, one of the great clear thinkers. He has not received until recently the full recognition in these lines which he deserved, because he wrote before the days of printing. And the result was that his actual writings were not copied in hundreds of copies which would be made available, easily available for study. And it's only within this last century that Wycliffe's writings have been gathered together and have been published in good edition. Of course, the great bulk of his writing is naturally in Latin, so that it is not easily available for most people today. But a considerable amount of it has been translated, and we can see what a great scholar he was. He was recognized as such by his contemporaries, those who were associated with him. But his writings did not have great vogue after his death. And so within this last century, they have been reproduced for the study of scholars, reproduced in full, and people realize more, as his contemporaries and associates realize, what a great scholar and what a great thinker he was. But as he began early in his life to speak against, first against the claims of the Avignon Pope against England in the political and economic sphere, he began to speak about that, and most Englishmen stood with him on that. And then he began to speak about certain abuses. And then many of the clerical leaders in England were ready to stand with him and to defend him against the attempts of the higher clergy to bring pressure against him. And the son of the king, John of Gaunt, strongly took his stand at that point. But then as Wesley went on studying further, and especially laying his great stress on the fact that the Word of God is the only source of knowledge in spiritual things, and we must study this, and this is what matters, and then began to see how much of Romanist teaching and attitude was built up on superstition and tradition that developed in the Middle Ages and not founded on the Word of God, he began to take positions which turned the leaders, perhaps the upper half of the clergy, strongly against it in England. And the lower half was not particularly aware of the situation, so their influence didn't come from much in those days. And then as he went further and took transubstantiation, which was the basic central stone in the control of the Roman Church over people's lives, because it seemed as if no salvation was possible without it, and only through the power of the priest to perform this miracle could it be done. And as he said that this was a silly superstition with no warrant whatever in Scripture, now he got the whole established system dead against it. And he was dropped from Oxford. He was exiled from Oxford and spent his last few years in the little town in Lutterworth, from which, however, he sent out his representatives throughout England, these poor priests, as they call them. And doubtless his activity would have been brought to a complete end. He probably would have been killed if it were not for the fact that now the schism was just about to begin, or had just begun, I guess. And the two popes were fighting against each other and excommunicating each other and calling each other worse names than which was called both of them. And there was a rather confused situation as far as the general world was concerned during Wycliffe's last year. And he had a stroke while he was conducting a service and died soon after there. And but his associates attempted to carry on his work, and it probably would have developed into a rather strong and effective work were it not that the ecclesiastical officials very soon began to bring a strong pressure against him. And some of his followers were burned at the stake, others were killed. People were terrified about being thought of as being associated with him. And yet, a century and a half after, there were a few people in England who were proud to call themselves followers of John Wycliffe. But at this time, people who loyally followed the established system, particularly on the continent, as they saw what Wycliffe was doing, and saw what a disturbance was being made to the established system by his followers in England, and then saw on the continent the two popes calling each other the worst names you can imagine, and excommunicating one another and calling it, declaring anybody would go to hell, each of them declaring who would support the other one, and so on. Why, people who wanted the established system to continue were very much disturbed over the situation of papacy, and they were very much disturbed over Wycliffeism, which they felt to be a very serious problem. And it was very shortly, 3 or 4 years after Wycliffe's death, that Chaucer began to write his Canterbury Tales. And so, Wycliffe being as well known as he was then, it is not at all impossible that those are correct who think that that fine description of a truly Christian part, which is contained in Chaucer's work, along with his ridicule and scorn of the pardoner and the friar, may indeed have referred to Wycliffe. But we can't say it did, because Chaucer does not specifically give any name. Well, now, I believe that I will stop the discussion of the 14th century at this point. There are very important developments which occur right in the period between 1380 and 1410. Very important developments. And so one hesitates which place to put them. But we have already spoken of the beginning of the Great Schism. And we'll speak further about it under our next main head, which will be number 13. Number 13 will be the 15th century. And perhaps before we start telling about the important things of the 15th century, we should say a word about the great joy which came to Urban VI's successor in Rome when he held a great jubilee starting of the century and offered great indulgences to any who would come to Rome and go to certain churches there. And thousands of pilgrims came to Rome, and a great amount of money flowed in to the papal coffers. I did not mention when we spoke of Boniface VIII a century earlier that he was the one who got the clever idea of holding a jubilee on the beginning of the century. And in 1300, Boniface VIII, who was then recognized by everyone as the pope, the successor of Hildebrand and of Innocent III, and his big troubles with the King of France were just beginning, and he'd been rather successful in some of his other difficulties, in 1300, Boniface VIII had declared a jubilee and promised great indulgences to all who would come to Rome at that time. And to everyone's surprise, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims came to Rome in 1300. And they say that the priests stood in front of the great churches with rakes, raking in the gold coins that were deposited there by the pilgrims. And it was such a wonderful thing that after Boniface VIII, the next pope decided not to wait a century, have one in 50 years. And then the next pope decided not to wait 50, so he had one in 30 years after that. But the next big one came in 1400. But it was not as big as the one in 1300, because the pope was only recognized by about half of Christendom at that time. And so we will make A under 13, the problem of the papal schism. The problem of the papal schism. And here we look back to the beginning of the schism, which we discussed rather fully some time ago. And we remember how there was great pressure brought on the Pope to return to Rome. And the city of Rome itself, with no great ruler there, was degenerated and becoming the prey of hostile factions and petty nobles and falling into such decay. And if Rome disappeared, how could the Bishop of Rome continue to be a great figure? And St. Bridget of Sweden and St. Catherine of Siena in Italy had come to see the popes and brought great pressure on them to leave Avignon and go back to Rome. And then you remember how the cardinals all went to Rome. That one pope moved back to Rome. The cardinals were there. He died. And they elected Urban VI, an Italian. And, of course, the Roman people were also terribly excited, but some say the excitement came after the election rather than before. At any rate, if Urban VI had been a man of reasonable tact, he probably would have been successful. But he was a man who had certain ideals. He does not seem to have been a corrupt man like most of the Avignon folks. He does not seem to have been a man who was seeking simply his own gain or his own pleasure, but he had a tremendous idea of what his power and authority was supposed to be. And when he saw the pettiness and the wickedness of many of the cardinals, he began reprimanding them in language they did not like. And he began slapping their faces and doing things like that, and showed himself a man with a hot temper and not much understanding of how to deal with people. And they got so disgusted that they withdrew from Rome and went to another city in Italy, and the same cardinals, every single one of them, who had voted to elect Urban, either voted or stood by silently without rendering any dissent when they elected a very politic and tactful Frenchman to be the Pope, and said that the election of Urban VI had been made under duress, under fear of the mob, and therefore was not a valid election. And after this, there was a certain amount of fighting in Italy, but eventually the Urban VI gained control of most of the churches of most of Italy. The King of France strongly supported the new French Pope. The University of Paris said, "We do not know what the true situation is. We will maintain neutrality until it becomes clarified." But the King of France brought great pressure on them, and the French Pope came back to Avignon. Their contacts were more with him, and before long, the whole French nation rallied to the French Pope. And so you had the two popes. And the French Pope died within a few years. And then his cardinals proceeded to elect a Spaniard as Pope. And this Spaniard, some say, would have been one of the greatest and most able of all the popes if he had been elected Pope at a time when there was no such division. But under the circumstances, he becomes a ridiculous figure, and one who is not honored by anyone much. He had great ability, but the French didn't like it. They said, we had a French Pope. We've had all these French Popes. Now what do they have to elect a Spaniard for? So the French continued to give their support to the Avignon Pope, but somewhat half-heartedly, particularly on the part of the king. Spain was happy that the Pope had been succeeded by a Spaniard, and the Spanish followed him. The English always ready to differ with the French if at all possible, and when the Pope was in France at Avignon, the English had been loyal to him, but they had objected to the heavy tribute he asked and had taken strong measures cutting down in general the power of the papacy regards England. But now that there were two popes, they gave their support strongly to the Roman Pope. And so the nations of Europe rather divided up between the two, and it was a very involved situation. Now this second pope of the Avignon line, who became pope in 1394, did not die until 1424. And so he had 30 years in which he considered himself to be the head of all Christendom, and in which he declared his excommunications and his curses for all eternity upon all who refused to recognize his claim. In Rome, the first of these popes lived till 1389, was succeeded by a man who reigned 15 years, and then he by one who was two, and then he by one who was 9 years. And let you see, you had a succession in Rome. And the cardinals of the Roman Pope had not continued. He elected new cardinals, appointed new cardinals, of course. They were not so enthusiastic because he had appointed 14 cardinals, and when he didn't like five of them, he had them arrested and two of them executed. And they were not so enthusiastic about him, but they maintained he was the true pope. And when he died, they proceeded to elect another, but they said this schism is a bad thing. Italy was divided for a long time between them. Only after a time did all of Italy come to support the Roman pope. But they were divided, and Europe was divided between these popes, and cardinals of both of them said there ought to be a reunion. And so when each of the Roman cardinals was elected, they always made him promise that he would do everything he possibly could to heal the system. And he always promised. But he always meant to get the other man to resign and make me be the supreme pope. And when the second Avignon pope was elected, his cardinals made him promise that he would do everything possible to heal the city. And he promised so to do, but he proceeded to act in such a way that it was clear that what he meant by healing the system was for the other fellow, whom he called the pretended pope, the antipope, that scion of the devil, and then he called him by his personal name, who called himself so-and-so, giving his faithful name, that he should resign. Now, sometimes they wrote much more politely than that. They wrote to each other, and each of them would say that he would go and discuss things with the other, but the other must first come halfway. And neither of them would move very far until the other did. And so, though the cardinals were anxious they get together, the pope pretended to be, but kept putting obstacles in the way. And so, people were disturbed about three things. They were disturbed about the system. They were disturbed about the rise of heresy. Wycliffeism had quite a vogue in England, and there were those on the continent who were followed. We will speak of some of them somewhat at length in a few minutes. But there were, I guess we should speak about them now, and we'll come back to this. So we will make B the Council of Pisa. The Council of Pisa, P-I-S-A. You remember that in the previous century, some of the great writers, Marsilius of Padua, and, yes? The other two things were the rise of heresy and the corruption of the church. We'll speak about each of them somewhat. No. A was the problem of the papal schism, and in connection with that, I mentioned they were disturbed about three things, and we'll talk about those three things considerably more later. They were important in the Council of Pisa, so it's good to mention the three right now. Number one is the papal schism. Number two is the spread of heresy. And by heresy here, some of them didn't mean so much people who disagree with doctrine as people who refuse to join in a unified church. People who say the Bible is the source of knowledge, we don't have to be subject to any ecclesiastical ruler. That was perhaps not expressly stated quite so strongly as that, but when you insist on the primacy of the Bible, that is the natural conclusion. It is stated very clearly in our Presbyterian Westminster Confession, which says that synods and councils may err and have erred ever since the days of the apostles. Any number of human beings may be wrong. The question is, what does the Bible say? That was Wycliffe's view. That, of course, we believe to be the truly scriptural view. And that is the view which Wycliffe maintained. And, of course, that meant the non-continuance of a system which paralleled the empire, in which you had a supreme authority with others owing authority to him. And many of the people who were strongly against heresy were not so much against doctrinal divergence as they were against breaking the unified system of authority throughout the church. And this unified system through the Middle Ages did not reach into every detail of life nearly as fully as it did in the Roman Catholic Church after the time of the Reformation. They would take individual things and get disturbed about them, like the Albigenses, and make a great fight against them. But in general, there was a great amount of freedom within the organization of the church prior to the Reformation. But that was the second thing, the growth of heresy. And the third was the widespread corruption of the church, which we will talk of much more at length before the end of the semester, because it forms background to the Reformation, but which was obvious to everyone. There were great Christian leaders and fine Christian teachers in every country in Europe. But a very great number of the religious authorities were men who gloried in the position they had, the prominence they had, the money they got. It reminds me of a time when I went to a presbytery meeting out in California, and they asked people present to speak about, introduce themselves. And a man would get up and he'd say, I live in such and such a town. I am secretary of the Rotary Club there. I am actively engaged in community affairs. And on Sundays, I preach in such and such a church. And man after man seemed to be more interested in his involvement in community affairs than in his position as a minister of a certain church. Of course, that was the beginning in those days of the development we have now, where the social activity of the church is the thing that has been become dominant in most of our large denominations. But in those days, the kings, the rulers, looked for able associates who were educated, and the best place to get them was in the church. And the kings and the nobles gave their positions, the political positions, to their firstborn son, but they didn't like to have their second son have nothing to do and no standing, and so they tended to try to get him a good position in the church. And so it was very common. The corruption, you see, went both ways. And there was the ignorance among the general mass of the clergy was very widespread, and corruption was recognized by everyone. And many said the church needs a reform in head and members. That was a very common statement during this century. And so there was held in 1409, a council at the Italian city of Pisa, at P-I-S-A. You all have heard of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, of course. Well, that is the town where the council was held, a town maybe an hour's drive from Florence, which we spoke last time. And many of the cardinals of the who were supporting the Roman, who had been appointed by the Roman Pope, and many of the cardinals who were had been appointed by the Avignon Pope, united in calling a council at Pisa. In the previous century, some of the great writers had said, the Pope is the executive head of the church, but authority rests in the church as a whole, and a council has the authority. And you can appeal from the wrong decision of a Pope to the decision of a council. And so these cardinals agreed that they should have a council at Pisa, at which the whole church could be represented, a council which should solve the schism and also deal with the other two great problems which were before the church at the time. And when they met in Pisa, there were 14 cardinals there, number afterwards increased to 24. There were 10 archbishops, 79 bishops and representatives, 116 other bishops, 128 abbots and priors, and the representatives of 200 other abbots. This gives you an idea of the size of the council. It was not just a few people gathering together. It was people from both groups. It was a large group which claimed to represent the church as a whole. The generals of the Dominican, Franciscan, Carmelite, and Augustinian orders were there, the Grand Master of the Knights of St. John, many leaders from various countries. They met there in Pisa in order to consider the state of the church and what should be done about it. And so, meeting there, they called upon the Roman Pope, who was then called Gregory, and the Avignon Pope, who was then called Benedict. They called them by name to appear before the council and to give reasons why they should not be deposed. And they sent representatives 3 different days to the door of the cathedral, solemnly calling these men by name and summoning them to appear and answer. And they were given a period of 2 weeks to appear, and when neither of them appeared, then the council took an action declaring that these two men had apostatized from the church. They were neither of them any longer worthy of support by virtue of the authority resting in the church as a whole. They declared that both of them were deposed, and they proceeded to elect another man as the pope. And then the council adjourned, and the members lost interest after the election of the new pope and began to withdraw. And the promises that there wouldn't be any adjournment till measures had been taken to reform the church in head, and members couldn't be fulfilled because now they had a new pope and they deposed both of the others. So many people left that they couldn't make much progress. So they appointed some commissions to consider this, and the council adjourned. But there were many people who still supported the Avignon pope. Pedro de Luna, who called himself Benedict, he was a very strong man, a very able man, and many still supported him. Gregory, the pope, the successor, fourth down the line from Urban VI, refused to submit, and much of Italy went over to the new Pisan pope. But there were still those who supported Gregory. And so the new situation was that there were three popes instead of two. And so the schism was worse. You had three popes instead of two. The new pope appointed by the Pisan Council appointed a number of cardinals. Some of the former cardinals joined with him. He appointed some new ones. He died within 2 years, less than 2 years. And the man who was elected his successor by the cardinals, rumors were spread that he had administered poison to his predecessor. And so, anyway, this man, Balthasar Cosa, took on the authority that the Pisa Council had said belongs to the true pope, and called himself John the 23rd. You remember John the 22nd? He called himself John the 23rd. And the greater part of Italy supported him, although Gregory still had a few who supported him. And so now you have three popes instead of two. The situation was worse than it had been before. Yes?
Is this
Pisa? No. No. He ruled in Rome. He got control of Rome in Rome. Well, wherever he could get people's support. He had a fair amount of Italy supporting him. But Balthasar got John 23rd got control of the city of Rome after some fight. But Italy was divided, some supporting one, some supporting the other. Many other countries were the same way. Though France nominally supported the Avignon pope, he was a Spaniard, and many of the French preferred to support the Pisa pope. The year situation after the Council of Pisa was worse than ever. And so they more and more felt the need of a new pope. But before we go on to that, we must look at the second of the reasons why they felt a council was necessary, the spread of heresy, but we will title C, John Huss. John Huss. Now, when Wycliffe was in his prime, the King of England was a young man named Richard II. And Richard II married a Czechish woman. We call it, the Germans called the land Bohemia. They called themselves Czech. And from this land, with its headquarters at Prague, which then had one of the very leading universities of Europe, perhaps second to Paris as the greatest university of Europe at this time, from Prague, there came the daughter of the Czechish king to marry King Richard II. And she brought a fine retinue with her, and lived in England a few years, and eventually returned to Czechoslovakia, two countries, Czechia and Slovakia, were united together. But she returned to Bohemia, as it's more generally called, though that's the German name, I think, rather than what they call it themselves, And some of her people who were with her in England had become very much attached to John Wycliffe, and they took John Wycliffe's writings back with them. And in Czechia, there was a man who was a fine scholar and a very able preacher, a man who carried tremendous weight with any who heard him preach. And this man's name was John Huss, and it is spelled many different ways. The way I've usually seen it is H-U-S-S. Sometimes it's spelled with just one S. Sometimes it's spelled even H-U-S-A. But John Huss was an able preacher and a good scholar, active in the University of Prague. But whether he was himself a great thinker, we are not in a position to judge. He had been born in 1369 in southern Bohemia. He was highly educated, but he evidently was so impressed with Wycliffe's writings and Wycliffe's teachings that he began to preach what Wycliffe had preached. And in recent years, scholars have gone through some of his sermons and found word for word translations of what Wycliffe gave, so that we see the great attachment that Huss felt for Wycliffe. Now, Wycliffe, he did not usually speak about Wycliffe. Everybody in Europe knew a little about Wycliffe, and people began to call him a Wycliffeite, and perhaps he thought it the wise thing. Wycliffe, having already died and having been condemned to a great extent, he saw nothing to be gained by speaking frequently of his great debt to Wycliffe, though he did speak occasionally of how highly he honored with John Wycliffe. But he did not perhaps had not read the last of Wycliffe's writings. There is no evidence that he went quite as far in his revolt against medieval teachings as Wycliffe did. But he was a much greater preacher, had a personality that attracted people, and he preached all over Czechoslovakia, or Czechia, I guess maybe we should call it, and had a tremendous number of people who were utterly devoted to his teachings. And his teaching, as far as the authority of the Pope was concerned, and as far as the primacy of the Bible, and the great importance of careful study of it, of the fact that our faith must rest in Christ and Him alone, and that this business of worshiping saints and all that sort of folderol was nonsense, all this sort of thing, he was very effective. Now, he was such a fine speaker and such a fine master of the Czechish language that even 30 years ago, when the Austrian oppressors had succeeded in practically wiping out his followers from Czechoslovakia, and 95% of the people at least were faithful members of the Roman Church, yet most of the people in Czechia still 30 years ago were honoring John Huss for his great contribution to the Czechish language, for his all that he had done for their language. You see, he was a very able man, a man who had tremendous influence there, and who continued for 200 or 300 years to have a very large group of devoted followers. But the nation of Bohemia was largely standing behind him. There came a big dispute over it, and all the Germans left Prague. The university had 2,500 students. It dropped to 500 when the Germans and other people left and went because of the dispute over John Huss, and they founded the University of Leipzig in Germany, which became one of the great German universities. But Huss's influence was very great in Czechoslovakia. And so people began to feel, we must do something to stop the schism. We must also do something about the matter of these Wycliffeite teachings, which are spreading and which have such a great preacher and supporter as John Huss. Yes? It was when, as a result of the dispute over Huss, the German students all left Prague. And they against Huss, they went to Germany and founded the University of Leipzig. And the Prague University, which had 2,500 students, dropped to about 500 as a result. But John Huss was a very great Christian and a very great preacher, a very effective man. His name Huss in Czechish means goose. And so he would often sign his letters with a picture of a goose. And the people who supported him would put up little pictures of a goose here and there. But when eventually he was condemned, the best soldiers in Europe came to fight against the Czechs and to force them into subjection to the Pope. And the Czechish peasants with pitchforks and hoes went out and met the best soldiers of Europe and drove them back. And the result was that it was 200 years until they were able to subdue them. And when this happened, just at the time this happened, in Paris, a group of wild gypsies entered Paris. And somebody said, oh, this must be these Bohemians coming. And so the word Bohemian, which stands for one of the most sober and fine people in the world, came to be used to represent gypsies. And people talk of a Bohemian life in this country, which is as different as anything could be from what you would expect the Czech to be implicated in, or most of them ever would be. It's a strange thing how words change their meaning that way. We'll look at these details about the Czech later on in this connection and some next semester. When Luther began his work, all through Germany, they looked on the Hussites as wild revolutionaries. And it was some years before Luther could feel that he wanted anybody to think that he would have anything to do with John Huss. But then he read and studied Huss's writings, and he said Huss was exactly right, and took his stand beside the martyred Huss. But this is the second problem, C, and the third, the other, the corruption of the church. I'm not going to go into details on now. I've spoken of it in general, and we will hope to go into considerable detail of it before the end of the semester, because it is very important in the background of the Reformation. We speak of the Reformation and of the Counter-Reformation, because the Roman Church cleaned up a great many of these abuses after the Reformation had been 20 or 30 years underway. The McSorley's book speaks of it as Protestant Revolt and Catholic Reformation. But all recognize that Reformation, improvement of the corruption, doing away with many of the abuses, was an absolute necessity. And it was carried out. Many of these, you might say, superficial abuses, and yet very, very real abuses, they were remedied during the next century after the Reformation. Well, we look at them later, but now the result of all this was that the people all over Europe began to say the Council of Pisa did not succeed. We now have three different men instead of two. We must have a new council which can deal with this matter of the papacy and do away with having three popes, and which can deal with the matter of heresy, and which can also fix up the corruption in the church and make a reform in head and members. And so the agitation went on. Pope John 23rd sent his representatives to Bohemia, who tried to put a stop to John Huss's activities. John 23rd excommunicated him. They called on the Czechs to turn against him, but he had tremendous following among the Czechs. And the feeling developed all over Europe until the result was that there was a call for a new council. And so we will make D one of our main heads under the 15th century, the Council of Constance. And if you forget all other councils between 500 A.D. and 1800 A.D., do not forget the Council of Constance, because it is by far the most important of them all, I believe, from any viewpoint, certainly from the Protestant view, by far the most important council. And if anybody, if I ask on the final exam to discuss the Council of Constance, and somebody gives me a very fine account of the Council of Nicaea or the Council of Constantinople, I will not promise to maintain as much patience as I did the last time it happened, and still to give a passing mark in the course. But
this council was a very important council. And you now see the problems that brought about the council. Number one is the calling of the council. How were they to get such a council? Some said the church has a right to meet in council, the universal council, when it chooses, and to take such actions as are necessary for the welfare of the church. Others said, no, the Pope is the dictator of the church. You cannot have a council without the Pope's voice. But they said, which Pope? There were people who were recognized as saints and are worshipped to this day in the Roman Church who recognized each one of these three popes. I told you how in this book written by a nun, they have a picture of three popes looking absolutely identical. And the poor innocent layman stands in front, and his little child says, which pope is the right one? And he says, the one that the dove is over, the Holy Spirit. And there above one of them, which they have Rome written on, is the dove of the Holy Spirit. But of course, most of us can't see the dove, and most of them couldn't see. And so some of the finest saints supported each of these three. And certain of the nations supported each of the three. What could they do? Well, they tried to get all three to call it, and they didn't succeed. But they managed to get John 23rd to call it. And so John the 23rd called this new council to meet at the city of Constance. The city of Constance is right on the lake of Constance. This lake is on the border between the eastern border between Germany and Switzerland. It is a large lake there. There's a little town there just north of the lake. To this day, the town of Constance. And they selected this as being rather centrally located and also somewhat in the direction of Czechia, where they could deal with the problem over there a little more easily, perhaps. And they sent out a call with John the 23rd concurring in the call. And he thought he would be able to preside over it and doubtless become recognized as a result of it as the one pope, as of course had been the intention of Pisa, though he wasn't the man they'd elected. He was the one the cardinals had elected who supported the pope then. So they called this council to meet in Constance, and this council was supposed to meet on November 1st, 1414, and it lasted nearly 4 years. And it proved one of the most imposing gatherings that had ever convened in Western Europe. And the city contained 5,500 people when they began the council, but probably somewhere between 10,000 and 50,000 visitors came during the council. They included great numbers of kings, rulers of different nations, cardinals, bishops, all sorts of officials. I noticed some statistics here. 33 cardinals, 47 archbishops, 145 bishops, 217 doctors of theology, 361 doctors in both laws, 171 doctors of medicine. Besides a great number of masters of arts from the 37 universities represented, 83 kings and princes represented by envoys, 38 dukes, 173 counts, more than 1,500 knights, 1,700 buglers, fiddlers, and players on other musical instruments. 700 women of the street practiced their trade openly or in rented houses, while the number of those who practiced this secretly was a matter of conjecture. There were 36,000 beds for strangers. 500 people are said to have drowned in the lake during the progress of the council. Huss said, this council is a scene of foulness, for it is a common saying among the Swiss that a generation will not suffice to cleanse Constance from the sins which the council has committed in this city. The English and Scotch delegation was less than a dozen persons, but was accompanied by 700 or 800 mounted men, headed by fifers and other musicians, and made a great sensation at their entry into the city. And so the council was one of the great conspicuous events of the whole century. And they met during these 400 years, and some of the kings and some of the officials said the first thing to do is to reform the church, to do away with pluralism, such as where one bishop in England had 18 different important church offices in different parts of England. with a great palace in each one of the 18, and was deriving the income from all of these, while men who derived practically no pay were doing the actual church work in all of these areas. And this was the corruption of pluralism. And of course there was the corruption of immoral life, the corruption of simony, as they called it, when the Pope sold positions for a fee, and the bishop sold positions, and everybody had to pay a large sum to get these positions, which drew in incomes from endowments or from the contributions of the people. And the churches in the different countries by this time owned perhaps half of the land in the countries, because old people would die and would bequeath their money, their land to the church, and so the churches held these tremendous properties all over Europe, and the income from this came to the holders of these different positions. There was all this corruption. Some said we must heal the corruption in the church first. Others said we must deal with this problem of heresy first. We must settle that. And others said, no, we must settle the matter of the papacy. So in the end, they dealt first with the problem of heresy. They burned John Huss at the stake and some of his followers, and they ordered Wycliffe's body dug up and burned. And somebody said Wycliffe's body was dug up and burned. He'd been dead 30 years now. And the ashes of it were thrown into the river. And from this river, they passed into a larger stream, and then a larger stream, then out into the ocean and disseminated all over the world. That's what somebody wrote 150 years later. But that would not have been the fact if it hadn't been for Martin Luther's activity of 150 years later. But they dealt vigorously with what they considered heresy, even some of those who were most opposed to the papal abuse. And then they took up this matter of the popes, but we can't discuss that in a minute or two, so I won't ask you that on the test tomorrow.